The war in Gaza is having an outsized influence on the upcoming American election.
There would have been no war in Gaza with me in the White House. When I was president, we had peace in the Middle East like never before.
Plus, an economist becomes Russia's new defense minister.
It's an attempt by the Russian president to prepare Russia for economic war by trying to better utilize the defense budget and harness greater innovation to win in Ukraine.
And later, Russia gains in Ukraine. We'll have an update from Kyiv. And following the elections in Chad, what role can Western powers play in countering terror in the region? Today is Monday, May 13th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Satellite imagery showed the rapid growth of a displaced persons camp in southern Gaza as Israeli forces appeared to be pressing ahead with plans for a ground attack on Rafah. Israel called on Saturday for Palestinians in more areas of Gaza's southern city to evacuate and head to what it calls an expanded humanitarian area in Al-Mousawi. About 300,000 Gazans have so far moved towards Al-Mousawi, according to Israeli military estimates released on Saturday. That's local resident Fatia Ahmed. She says she doesn't have a choice but to flee, and that if she were free, she would have stayed home. With the United States recently deciding to pause some shipments of aid to Israel ahead of an expected incursion into Rafah, the war in Gaza has now become part of heated rhetoric on the U.S. presidential campaign trail. Donald Trump has joined other Republicans in criticizing his political rival, President Joe Biden, for his stance on the matter. Veronica Balderas Iglesias has that story.
It was a somber Sunday in Israel as it marked Memorial Day for its fallen soldiers and victims of terror. Across the border, displaced Palestinians heeded evacuation orders ahead of Israel's planned expansion of its military operations against Hamas in Rafah, the southern city in Gaza. What is happening on the other side of the world is also strongly resonating on the campaign trail in the United States. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump brought up the Israel-Hamas war when addressing a crowd of almost 100,000 of his supporters Saturday in Wildwood, New Jersey.
There would have been no war in Gaza with me in the White House. When I was president, we had peace in the Middle East like never before.
Trump and other Republicans have strongly decried the Biden administration's recent decision to pause certain bomb shipments to Israel in the context of unfolding events in Rafah. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham framed his criticism Sunday in the context of World War II. He was interviewed on NBC's Meet the Press.
When we were faced with destruction as a nation after Pearl Harbor, fighting the Germans and the Japanese, we decided to end the war by bombing Hiroshima and Nagasaki with nuclear weapons. That was the right decision. Give Israel the bombs they need to end the war they can't afford to lose and work with them to minimize casualties.
But even as some weapons shipments have been paused, a recent State Department report to Congress failed to conclude that Israel has violated U.S. and international law when using military assistance during its war against Hamas. Secretary of State Antony Blinken was asked on NBC whether the U.S. is avoiding holding its ally accountable.
No. We don't have double standards. We treat Israel, one of our closest allies and partners, just as we would treat any other country. And when we can reach definitive conclusions, we will. But it's very difficult to do that in the midst of a war.
Progressive independent Senator Bernie Sanders, who aligns with Democratic opposition to Israel's conduct of the war, told NBC that in his view, Israel should not be receiving another nickel in U.S. military aid.
35,000 Palestinians dead and 77,000 wounded, two-thirds of whom are women and children. That is not the way you conduct a war in a civilized society to the degree that war is civilized.
It is expected that Joe Biden, who has so far been able to strike a balance between his re-election bid and his official duties as president, will face new challenges this coming week by congressional Republicans over the pause of some military transfers to Israel. Donald Trump, meanwhile, will return to the courtroom on Monday and face his former fixer, Michael Cohen, as Cohen testifies in Trump's New York hush money trial. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
The Judicial Committee of Georgia's Parliament has approved the third reading of the Foreign Agents Bill on Monday, clearing the way for the full parliament to vote this week on completing its passage. It's very similar to a law in Russia, at a time when much of Georgia's population is more interested in aligning with Europe and the West. For some context, I'm joined by Eka Magaldadze of VOA's Georgian service.
As you said, it's a controversial so-called foreign agents bill that is expected to be approved this week, actually tomorrow. The legislation that is offered by the ruling party actually is called the Law on Transparency of Foreign Influence. If passed, the law would require any non-governmental organization or any non-profit, including the media outlets, that receive more than 20% of their funding from abroad, to register as entities pursuing the interests of foreign power and provide the financial statements, of course, and if they fail to do so, it would result in fines.
So just understanding the finances of different organizations in a country, on the face of it, doesn't seem so outrageous. What is the main problem that the protesters against this bill have?
Yes, that's what Georgian government says, that it's about the transparency, and the transparency cannot be not European, not Western. That's actually the major argument of people who offered this law. But the demonstrators and the opponents of this law believe that it would be used to silence the independent voices in the country, that the government has enough information about the whether it's financial annual reports or any other documents that they could have, that they anyways have about those organizations, and they do not need to have adopted the specific law about these organizations. Another thing that not only opponents in the country but the international watchdogs are underlining is the spirit of this law, is how it could label the civil society organizations and independent media outlets as pursuing the foreign interests. So this kind of stereotyping and labeling these organizations is also one of the concerns.
Now, this is coming at a time when many people in Georgia are looking towards Europe and looking towards the West as allies and as a place for Georgia to grow. This law is seen by critics as authoritarian in nature and more aligned with Russia. How is that duality? How is that conflict playing out inside Georgia?
Yes, that's true. We have heard very strong statements from the U.S. State Department, from the senators, who say that not only this law, but the overall the course of the Georgian government and Georgian ruling party, that could undermine U.S.-Georgia or EU-Georgia partnership and this important relationships that Georgia had throughout the decades and its aspirations towards the Euro-Atlantic institutions. It's worth mentioning that in the country there is the overwhelming support to EU membership, European integration, NATO. Polls repeatedly show, including by NDI, IRI, and other institutions, they repeatedly show that Georgians support the country's EU accessions. They believe its future lies with the West. So this law that is widely believed to be a Russian-style or Russian-inspired law causes even more criticism and fear in some regard. Many believe that this would undermine Georgia's path towards EU. And actually, we have heard a lot of statements by EU officials as well that this is not the path that the candidate country shall be taking.
Eka Makhaldadze of VOA's Georgian service. Eka, thanks very much for your reporting today. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Moving now to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Russian authorities blame fragments of a falling Ukrainian missile for a deadly collapse of an apartment building in Belgorod. So far, no comment from Kyiv. This as Russian forces continue to capture Ukrainian territory in the north. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has the story.
CCTV footage captures the moment a projectile partially collapses a building block in the Russian city of Belgorod near the border with Kharkiv in Ukraine. The local governor reports 7 fatalities and at least 19 injuries. Russia's investigative committee, the country's top law enforcement agency, blamed the attack on fallout from a Russian intercepted missile fired from Ukraine. Ukraine so far offers no comment. The news comes amid intensifying Russian airstrikes, paving the way for renewed ground attacks in the Kharkiv region. There, over the weekend, police say they evacuated more than 900 people to a nearby village.
Bombs are flying. My house is on fire and my husband is under the rubble and he doesn't respond. Now they took me away and my daughter is in Kharkiv. I don't know if she called to pick me up. Don't know, and now I don't have a passport. I don't have anything.
The head of the city's military administration called Russia a nation that destroys, adding that the city's proximity to Belgorod, roughly 50 kilometers away, keeps Ukrainians living here in danger. While Russia works to spread out Ukrainian frontline positions, Kyiv recently secured an outpouring of financial and material commitment from its Western partners. A recent Ukrainian attack at an oil depot in Russian-occupied Luhansk led to 18 separate fires, 3 deaths, and 8 injuries that the Moscow-appointed regional figurehead blamed on advanced U.S.-supplied missile systems. Britain estimates at least 450,000 Russian soldiers have been killed or injured so far in Moscow's invasion, far higher than any publicly acknowledged figure from the Kremlin. Despite those losses, Russia deploys a so-called meat grinder approach at sending wave upon wave of soldiers to wear down Ukrainian forces, a strategy keeping frontline medics busy. Ukrainian soldier Artem, giving only his call sign for security reasons, speaking with AP.
A drone found us. A second drone immediately flew in, saw our position, and immediately the motor started working a couple of meters away from us. Then I remember how I ran back, and my eyes darkened, and that was it.
Ukraine's army now fights a defensive battle along a roughly 1,000-kilometer front line ahead of what officials say they believe could be a bigger Russian offensive. As of now, they are outnumbered in infantry, armor, and ammunition. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Vladimir Putin has named an economist as his new defense minister. We'll learn more about Andrei Belousov in a few moments. First, though, fierce battles are taking place in Ukraine's northeastern Kharkiv region as Russian forces are exploiting Ukraine's weaknesses before a big batch of new military aid from the U.S. and European partners arrives. VOA's Lori London spoke with correspondent Anna Chernikova in Kyiv.
Situation is extremely difficult at this point. This is what is reported. What we know at this point, that from the end of last week, over the weekend and during Monday, Russian forces continue to push and continue to try to break through the Ukrainian defense in the area of northeast of the Kharkiv region. We are talking now about the city of Vovchansk, which is one of the main targets so far due to its location. And this city was already under occupation at the beginning of full-scale Russian invasion. And this is also one of the reasons why people there are afraid even more, because they've already been through this. And a lot of people are evacuating. However, some people remain in the territories and refuse to evacuate. So Russian forces are pushing. They are having certain tactical advance and they are having certain success in that area. We are talking also not only about the territory which is completely under Ukrainian control, but also we're talking about the line next to the border, which was from the beginning of full-scale invasion and after Ukrainian forces liberated most of Kharkiv region, that area remained a so-called gray zone. And this gray zone was under control of none of the sides. Now we have information and proof that Russian forces enter that zone and Russian forces have control over that zone. But Ukrainian defense lines remain at the same positions as they were.
And what about the city of Kharkiv?
So as we understand, the city of Kharkiv, well, is kind of the main target for this operation, for this new assault that Russian forces are ongoing through. And at this point, Ukrainian authorities are saying that the city of Kharkiv is safe from the land assault, but the city of Kharkiv remain under very heavy shelling. And the situation is very disturbing, of course, and Kharkiv citizens are really afraid and disturbed about the fact that Russian forces are getting closer. But at this point, it's too early to say that the city of Kharkiv has any danger of experiencing a land assault, at least while Ukrainian defense lines remain stable.
Lori Lunzen hosts Flashpoint Ukraine. Here on The Voice of America, she was speaking with Anna Chernikova in Kyiv. Russian President Vladimir Putin has tapped a civilian economist as his surprise choice for a new defense minister on Sunday. It's an attempt to better integrate Russia's military spending into the country's overall economy. Reuters' Gabe Singer has the story.
It's an attempt by the Russian president to prepare Russia for economic war by trying to better utilize the defense budget and harness greater innovation to win in Ukraine. More than 2 years into the conflict, which has cost both sides heavy casualties, Putin proposed Andrei Belousov to replace his long-term ally Sergei Shoigu as defense minister. Belousov is a 65-year-old former deputy prime minister who specializes in economics and has played an important role in overseeing Russia's drone program. He is known to be very close to Putin and shares the Russian leader's vision of rebuilding a strong state. Meanwhile, Putin wants Shoigu to become the secretary of Russia's powerful Security Council. His new job is technically regarded as a step up to his defense ministry role, which ensures continuity and allows him to save face. Shoigu was heavily criticized by Russian military bloggers for a series of retreats the Russian military was forced to make in 2022. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said the change made sense because Russia was approaching a situation like the Soviet Union in the mid-1980s, when the military and law enforcement authorities accounted for 7.4% of gross domestic product. Peskov said that meant it was vital to ensure such spending was better integrated into the country's overall economy. It was why Putin now wanted a civilian economist in the defense ministry job, Peskov added. Russia's economists have so far largely ensured economic stability and growth despite the toughest sanctions ever imposed on a major economy. The changes are the most significant Putin has made since launching what he called a special military operation in Ukraine in 2022. They indicate Putin is eager to harness more of Russia's economy for the Ukraine war.
That's Gabe Singer of Reuters reporting for us. And now to Africa. We heard on this program last week that Mahmoud Debi was declared winner of the recent election in Chad. Western powers are watching to see what role, if any, they can play in countering terror threats in the Sahel region. Henry Wilkins has more.
Mahmoud Debi's election as Chad's president follows the 2021 death of his father, Idriss Deby, and marks the completion of the country's three-year transition from military rule. It also means the Deby family has ruled Chad since 1990. The younger Deby, the former military ruler, won the presidency last week. Western powers watched the results of the election closely, while critics denounced the vote as neither free nor fair. In the last 2 years, Sahel countries fighting insurgencies with militant groups linked to Islamic State and Al-Qaeda have severed security ties with Western partners, particularly France and the United States. Chad is the last of these countries to maintain a military link with those countries. Asked if Western nations will be eager to work with Deby now that he is a civilian and not a military ruler, one analyst replied,
He is more legitimate to a certain extent, both domestically and internationally. So there is less pressure that can be exerted on him to go one way or another. He has a mandate. Whether the elections were free and fair is a different question. This is debated. But at least he has this title. He is now the new elected president of Chad.
Some analysts say Deby is trying to leverage his power as the last remaining Western partner in the Sahel conflict to gain better contributions from them. Many Sahel countries have turned to Russia for military assistance in confronting terrorists. Days before the election, some of the US troops based in Chad were asked to leave. The United States has said it's keen to negotiate the return of the troops now that the election is over. Gouvy thinks Washington may confront Deby on the issue, even as attention shifts to other parts of the continent.
I think in general we've seen interest waning since probably around 2021, shift focus away from the Central Sahel and towards countries on the Gulf of Guinea, coastal states.
Another analyst, Dan Izenga of the Washington-based Africa Center for Strategic Studies, says he doesn't think the U.S. does want to further disengage from Chad, but may be looking to reassess how it engages with the region.
Have we been acting in accordance with our values and interests, or have we been acting in ways that are perhaps counterproductive, or if not counterproductive, not necessarily moving the needle in the direction that we would like to see in terms of improved security or improved development or, improved socioeconomic conditions just for people in general.
Several analysts told VOA that despite Deby's victory, he is not immune to being ousted in a coup. Coups are increasingly common in the Sahel, leading to the nickname Africa's Coup Belt. This will also play into
how much to invest and whether or not it's really of value to remain connected deeply to a partner that has just inherent instability baked in.
Analysts agree Deby's relationship with France, which has around 1,000 troops based in Chad, is unlikely to change, however. Henry Wilkins, VOA News.
Flash floods caused by heavy rains have devastated villages in northern Afghanistan, killing over 300 people and injuring more than 1,600, authorities said on Sunday. This as villagers buried their dead and aid agencies warned of widening havoc. Rachel Judah of Reuters has the story.
The Taliban-run refugee ministry says thousands of homes have been damaged and livestock wiped out following heavy rain. Meanwhile, aid groups warn of widening havoc as healthcare facilities and vital infrastructure have also been damaged. For those who have survived, like Mohammed Yaqub, their focus is burying the dead.
The flash floods destroyed all our houses. I lost 13 members of my family, including women and children.
But moving forward isn't simple, and people are struggling to cope.
We have no food, no drinking water, no shelter, no blankets, nothing at all.
In a statement, the Taliban's economy minister urged the United Nations and private businesses to provide support for those affected by the flooding. Afghanistan is prone to natural disasters, and the UN considers it one of the countries most vulnerable to climate change. But following the Taliban takeover after foreign forces withdrew in 2021, it's battled a shortfall in aid. That's because development aid that formed the backbone of government finances was cut. This has worsened in subsequent years as foreign governments grapple with competing global crises and growing condemnation of the Taliban's curbs on Afghan women.
That's Rachel Judah of Reuters reporting for us. And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Carrick.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with a 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.